You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at civilpodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at civilpodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up on our homepage. I'm Dan Gould. Robert McGrath moved to Charlottesville in 2007 after retiring from the State University of New York at Stony Brook. For almost a decade before retirement, he held concurrent positions as provost and executive vice president for academic affairs and also vice president for Brookhaven National Laboratory Affairs. He is professor of physics emeritus. He did accelerator-based nuclear physics research for most of his academic career. In retirement, he has adopted climate change as an avocation and has studied the public perception of science. Mr. McGrath spoke at the April 9, 2010 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Charlottesville Senior Center. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV Vice President Sue Liberman.
Hi, I'm Sue Liberman. I have been given the illustrious title of Vice President of Senior Statesmen of Virginia. And certainly welcome, and I hope that everybody here will feel free after the program to indulge in some refreshments. We thought that might be a nice little added attraction. So please help yourselves. I'm going to get right to the point and introduce our speaker to you today, who may look familiar. Bob McGrath, as we know him, because he is a member of Senior Statesmen, but officially Dr. Robert McGrath, moved to Charlottesville in 2007 after retiring from the State University of New York at Stony Brook. For almost 10 years before retiring, he held concurrent positions as provost and executive vice president for academic affairs at Stony Brook, and was also vice president for the Brookhaven National Laboratory. He is a professor emeritus of physics. Excuse me, I always trip over when I'm talking about extraordinarily bright people. Feeling very intimidated, but as a professor was doing accelerator-based nuclear physics research for most of his academic career, spanning 40 years. In retirement, Bob has adopted climate change as an avocation and has studied broadly both modern scientific literature and literature and or missives affecting how the public perceives science. He'll review for us today the status of discussions about climate change, discuss the predictions about what is to come, lament some of the overstatements and silliness surrounding climate change, and plea for serious debate on the subject as it deserves it. And without further tripping, Bob McGrath.
Thank you, Sue. My mother would have been proud of you for that introduction. As Sue said, I've spent considerable time as I've moved here to Charlottesville, because I had some time, wading into the huge and nuanced subject of climate science, the science of climate change, but also have had the fortitude to wade into a lot of the political battles that are going on right now. And I'm a little bit disgusted by what I see, and I want to lay some of the politics, at least, out in front of you. I want to end up being, a fairly equal opportunity critic of both camps in the climate wars, and I want to conclude by hoping upon hope where we might go with further discussion about climate. This picture I love. Can we turn? Thanks, Jim. So this is a satellite image, obviously, and it reminds us, as we gaze up into a blue sky, it looks like the air goes on forever, but actually 80% of the air, which is in the troposphere is only about 7 miles high at a latitude like we are here in Charlottesville, Virginia. So it's a very thin shell surrounding the globe in which we live. So this is what I'll talk about. I've already anticipated the points to the talk. I'll do some politics. I'm going to do some simple facts. They're not really debatable. They're just facts about what humans are actually doing to the environment. Of course, the debatable subject is, so what? What is it we're doing to the environment? What is that actually going to cause to happen? Very simple, short primer on climate science. Go over some of the silliness and hyperbole, because I think we've all been victims of it, and I hope you'll agree with me that it is silly, and we should move past that and then make some conclusions. So, and I said that I'd try to be an equal opportunity critic, the strategy here is sort of dumb, I guess, because this means one way or another I'll probably alienate everybody in the room. But in any event, I'll plunge ahead. So, politics and public attitude. Now, a lot of this you know, so forgive me. But the leaders of the group of G20 countries for years now have been on record as accepting essentially the findings and recommendations of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is a collaboration of hundreds of scientists from around the world that was formed under the auspices of the World Meteorological Organization and the UN Environmental Council. So it's really a UN operation. And those reports, as you probably know, say that if we don't curb our emissions of greenhouse gases, that the temperatures on Earth are going to go up inevitably, and there'll be other bad consequences. And so the leaders are on record as saying they're going to do what it takes to, according to the models, to keep increases of temperatures to no more than 2 degrees centigrade. Now, I use centigrade in the talk. Remember, a degree centigrade is 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit. So this is 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. So what's the U.S. political situation? Well, the President and the House have declared very dramatic, essentially disruptive, reduction goals for greenhouse gases of 20% by 2020 and 83% by 2050. Now, you probably know that almost a year ago, the House, after considerable debate and struggle, passed what was called the Clean Energy and Security Act, H.R. 2454, which has, amongst other things in it, these goals. So the House is on record as striving to meet those goals. Now, we also all know that there's predicted very, very heavy slogging ahead for the Senate to do anything. And in fact, in the paper this morning, I read that tomorrow there will be an up or down vote in the Senate on a resolution of disapproval of the U.S. EPA. The EPA findings said that greenhouse gases were harmful to public welfare and that they should be curbed, and they were going to act to do that. So the Senate already is having a vote tomorrow, up or down, on whether they do or do not disapprove of that. Now, the world looks to the U.S. because the U.S. by far produces more greenhouse gases than anybody else. Up until a few years ago, with 4% of the world population, we created 25% of the greenhouse gases. Right now, China and the U.S. together produce about 40% of the greenhouse gases. So it's obvious that not much is going to happen in terms of global policy changes, if in fact they're called for, unless the U.S. Figures out what it's determined to do on this subject. And because of that uncertainty, in the Copenhagen meeting last December, there was much written about how not much came out of that, and in fact not much did. And if you look at the confirmed proposals that went in there, if you model it, you might hold the temperatures to 4 degrees or something like that. So, okay, so the world looks to the U.S., but in the meantime, what do polls tell us the U.S. public thinks? Well, on the far right-hand column, there's some results from the Pew Research Center. You can see that a majority of citizens say that they think there's evidence that the Earth is warming. But if you ask warming because of human activity, the answer is barely more than a third of people believe that there's solid evidence for that. Entire sample, 36%. You see that there's a correlation with your political persuasion, 18% of Republicans, 50% of Democrats. The Miller, just, I need to master some technology here, which I'm incapable of. Oh, here. Well, that's not a very bright laser, but anyway. So in the fall of 2008, the Miller Center, our own Miller Center, conducted its own survey about what people thought on climate change. And I think these two questions really get to the litmus test for whether in your heart of hearts you believe we need to do something or not. You'll see that when asked the question, would you support increasing gasoline taxes to do something, the answer is 10% of people said yes. So with this kind of public opinion, I think if the answer is that we need to take dramatic greenhouse gas reduction actions, that it's very unlikely. I mean, the politicians, after all, know about these polls as well. So, okay, let's talk a little bit about how the public knows what it thinks about climate change. Now, I don't think I said when I started talking, but remember that never before in history has a large community of scientists challenged society to change fundamentally the way it has been doing business or else. That has never happened on any subject ever. And because of that, the science comes right smack grinding against public policy, public political philosophies, and so forth and so on. It is a subject that's huge. We all understand that. It's a subject that's complicated and nuanced, and somehow or other it would be good if the discussion itself could rise to the level that the issue really justifies and calls for, some serious discussion rather than soundbite kinds of things and this and that. And I'm afraid what's going on is that much of the public, I'm sure not you folks in the room, but anyway, much of the public thinks what it thinks because of sound bites that it's heard in the media, controversy. Often you'll get experts or so-called experts sort of arguing back and forth against each other. Doesn't seem to be much common ground at all. And of course, the media loves catastrophes. So too often, the latest storm, the latest drought, whatever, turns out to be the event of the century, brought about by, guess what? Global warming. And I think that's hype is just sort of turning people off and also confusing people. Well, one can go to the internet. That's a tough job, though, because if you put in climate change to Google, you get 22 million hits. Now, it's hard to read 22 million websites. But if you gird yourself and you wade into some of them, what you find is, and you're a member of the public and you want some enlightenment, what you find is that you're overwhelmingly likely to get a website that's really a site for partisan cheerleading and mudslinging, and it's part of the climate wars. And the lexicon that goes on back and forth in this war, on the one side, there are words used like alarmist, fundamentalists, that is, people believe that we're screwing up the environment more as a reason of faith than of science justification, or even that these people are hysterical. On the other side, labels of skeptics, deniers, as in deniers of the truth, traitors, as in traitors to the environment, and so forth, are bandied about. Now, excuse me, in this talk, I'm going to use as labels alarmists and skeptics just because I need something to label these folks. And I don't see anything polemic about that. There's nothing wrong with being an alarmist. After all, Paul Revere was an alarmist. So was Rachel Carson. On the other hand, skepticism is supposed to be a core principle of science. So there's absolutely nothing wrong with being skeptical. Scientists are supposed to make their case, or else you reject it and go on to something else. They're always movies. How many have seen Al Gore's movie? More than half. I saw it in 2006 with my wife, and I didn't know anything, and I was really impressed. I thought that we had to go out and do something immediately. What I'm really going to show you is, in a moment, there are some distortions and things in that movie that I think may have, on balance, hurt the case for doing things about climate change, because it's so easy to attack Gore himself and to make ad hominem arguments about the man as opposed to the science and the science case. And also, he's become, in many people's eyes, the spokesperson for climate science. Well, of course, he's not a scientist. He wouldn't say that he's a scientist. But in any event, that's the way it's played out. There are reports. Anybody that's particularly courageous can read these reports issued by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. There also is a program that was put in place by the first George Bush in 1990 and Congress, called the U.S. Climate Change Research Program, and it issues voluminous reports from a U.S. perspective every few years. And they're wonderful reports. It's just that all of these things are 1,000 or so pages long, and they tend to have a lot of technical things in them, and I doubt if many people read them, and I doubt if many people even in the media read them. U.S. political leadership. I don't see a lot of it, and so the bottom line is that if I walk down the aisles of the supermarket here in Charlottesville, I'm inclined to hear people saying things like, what's the big deal? It's been hotter or colder before. It's nature. Or, particularly last winter, when we finally got shoveled out, so what does Al Gore have to say about all this snow? Okay. Now, before we get on to some science and stuff, let me just, I can't resist sharing with you some of the quotes that are out there. They're pretty amazing. Politics and views on climate tend to be correlated. We talked about that a moment ago with the survey results. But here are some particularly astounding ones. Václav Klaus was president of the Czech Republic. He also was president of the EU for a while. And he's a favorite speaker at meetings of conservative think tanks. He's a free marketer beyond all free marketers. And so he says the theory of global warming is a very dangerous theory. Monckton, who has a hereditary title of Lord, is also a favorite at conservative think tank meetings. And they are about to impose a communist world government on the world. You have a president. He's speaking to a U.S. audience who has very strong sympathies with that point of view. Now, Senator Inhofe, Republican senator from Oklahoma, weighs in early and often on climate change, and he calls global warming the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on the American people. Now, on the other side, of course, there's Mr. Gore. And in his movie, he says the evidence that humans are causing global warming is overwhelming and undeniable. So, difference of opinion. Climate scientists. Scientists themselves, in most fields of science, they're kind of in the ivory tower. They debate amongst themselves. They make observations. They make tentative theories based on the observations. They make more observations, more experiments. They try to improve the theories. They try to reject the theories, whatever. But it's a process of evolution in understanding nature. Well, now, all of a sudden on this subject, the scientists are right smack up against the public and trying to affect public policy. And so they make some statements where the uncertainties and the tentativeness that surrounds science in any field of science, inevitably, that's what science means, tends to get downplayed, and they tend to get criticized for that. So President Obama's science advisor, John Holdren, is saying the business about a hoax, they need to think again. Stephen Chu is the Secretary of Energy. Pachauri has been the chair of the IPCC panel for many years. And since it's almost 2012 and we haven't yet taken action, I guess we're all doomed. I mean, that's a pretty strong statement. May be true, but there it is. And James Hansen, who is the world's probably the foremost climate modeler, is really out on the picket lines these days. You can see the things he says. And now the last little bit of anecdotal stuff I'll share with you. I think this would be funny if it weren't so sad, I think. So this is from Science Magazine from a few weeks ago. Now, Science Magazine is the one of the two most prestigious science journals in the world. The other one is Nature. And they published a letter from 250 members of the National Academy of Sciences. And the letter said, essentially, the case is made. Let's get on with taking actions to reduce greenhouse gases. Science Magazine accompanied the letter with an editorial. And the editorial says the IPCC reports have underestimated the pace of climate change, etc. And they adorned it with this picture. Now, it's a pretty forlorn-looking polar bear. And it's a pretty small piece of ice. Well, it took about a day until on the internet, some skeptic's website comes in with Photogate. Climate con continues. Letter signed by 250 warmest scientists, accompanied by faked polar bear photo. Science Journal uses photoshopped image. A day later, in the electronic version, they changed the illustration. Now, I guess two polar bears, and that's a bigger piece of ice, so I guess it isn't so alarming. In any event, the whole thing is just so silly, but I think it suggests the degree to which everybody is polarized over, or so many people are polarized over the whole issue. Okay, let's talk a little bit about some facts, and then let's talk about some climate science. CO2, now I'm going to talk loosely. It isn't just CO2 that is a human-related greenhouse gas. Methane is a potent greenhouse gas, nitrous oxide, ozone, some of the chlorocarbons. But I'm going to lump them together. I'm just going to talk about carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide one always generates when one burns fossil fuels, which have been underground for many, many millions of years. And I think this graph is striking to me, at least. This graph shows the world emissions of carbon dioxide since back in 1750, the beginning of the industrial era. And you might think that we've been producing a lot of greenhouse gases forever. Well, that's not true. I mean, right now, this ends at 2002. We're here in 2010. We're up here at 30 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide emitted every year. The curve is just shooting on up. Only three or four decades ago, you see, the production of CO2 was much, much less. So we really are changing things as the world population increases and as everybody, of course, wants improved material standards of living, which generally are related to how much fossil fuel usage you have. So let's look to see. So what? We put that carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. I should say that up until the 50s and 60s, that the most important scientists thought that probably humans could never significantly affect the composition of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere because the inventory of carbon, world inventory of carbon, overwhelmingly most of it is in the deep oceans and in sedimentary rocks. Only a little bit is in this thin layer of gas that we call the atmosphere, and about as much is in the biosphere that covers the Earth. But overwhelmingly, most of it is just down in those deep reservoirs. And so the thinking was whatever you stuck up there would just be absorbed and not much would happen. Well, in fact, you can see that's not the case. These beautiful measurements started back in about 1960, and before they started, the baseline for most of the industrial age was down around 280 molecules of carbon dioxide per unit volume of air. And you can see that this thing has gone up by about 100 parts per million over the space of about 50 years. Now, these beautiful little oscillations you can almost characterize as seeing the Earth breathe. Most plants are in the northern hemisphere, and they suck it, they grow. They take in carbon dioxide in the spring and summer, and then they die away, die back in the fall and winter. And so each year you go through that little oscillation, but that's not relevant to our talk today. So somehow or other, the atmosphere content of carbon dioxide is going up dramatically. Does that have anything to do with what I just showed you on the previous slide? Well, let's do a little arithmetic. We know how big the Earth is. We know its diameter, so we know what its surface area is. And maybe you all remember that atmospheric pressure at sea level is 14.7 pounds per square inch. So if you multiply that by the number of square inches on the surface of the Earth, you can find out the atmosphere weighs about 6 million billion tons. Well, that's a big number. But on the other hand, if you remember the curve we looked at two slides ago, and you just add up all the carbon dioxide we've emitted over the last 50 or so years, that turns out to be about 2,000 billion tons. If you take the ratio of those numbers, no problem at all, you can see that if all that stuff stayed in the atmosphere, that the concentrations would have increased by about 220 parts per million. So the interpretation is that the biosphere and the oceans are able to absorb roughly half of what we've been emitting up until now, but that as they're getting saturated, the experts believe that in the future, that's going to become less and less effective, absorbing the increased amounts of greenhouse gases that we're emitting. So that's a fact. There's nothing to debate about that. The question, of course, remains, well, so what? What does the carbon dioxide do? Okay. Now, before we get into that, I show this slide because of the comment, the supermarket aisle comment, that, oh, what's the big deal? Things have been hotter or colder before. Well, that's certainly true. But on the other hand, if you look, take a look backwards over the last 10 or 12,000 years, in other words, all of the time since we pulled out of the last glacial era, temperatures haven't changed all that much. This is the time when all of our modern civilizations have developed. Now, what are you looking at here? It's a messy plot. And you'll remember there weren't a lot of thermometers around in those days. So people result, and it's very arcane, specialized work, they result to making proxy temperature records by looking at ice core data, sedimentary core data, tree growth rings, and for more recent times, even anthropological data. And there's considerable debate amongst the experts. It's hard to see the different colors, but these are different sets of proxy temperature measurements. And you can see there's a lot of scatter, and there's debate about whether that's just because these measurements come from different points on the face of the Earth, or whether there may be even errors in the measurements. But let me not get into that, and let me just blithely look at a grand average of all of those things, which is this black line. And what I want to suggest to you is that looking back for 10,000 years, you look at the temperature scale over here, temperatures really haven't varied by more than about a degree centigrade. So I think if we're talking about temperature changes that are significantly more than a degree, then that begins to be interesting compared to the temperature variations that have gone on during the entire time our civilizations have developed. Okay, so climate science. Why do we have weather? Why do we have climate? Well, we all know that the Earth's temperature is determined by a balance between the incoming solar radiation and the outgoing heat radiation. The sun is very hot, so it's bright. The radiation it emits is in the visible spectrum. We see it. The Earth is not very hot. It emits the same kind of radiation, but it's infrared radiation because it's so much cooler. You don't see it. It's not visible. Greenhouse gases have been understood since the 19th century to actually be a very good thing. If it weren't for greenhouse gases in our atmosphere, our Earth's average temperature would be about 34 degrees colder than it is, and obviously we wouldn't have life as we know it if that were the case. Now, I want to just comment that I keep talking about CO2 and by implication methane, nitrous oxide, and so forth. Water vapor is the most potent greenhouse gas, but on the other hand, it isn't something that humans are turning a switch on and turning up or down. That's part of the hydrological cycle, and water vapor is certainly there, and it certainly acts as a greenhouse gas, but it's not something that the humans themselves are modulating. Okay, so movements of energy and masses of air make our weather and make our climate. And why do these movements happen? Well, we know that a region near the equator obviously gets more sun than the polar regions because of the orientation of the Earth. We also know that land, ice, and water reflect the sun's energy differently. And we also know from simple physics, if you all took introductory physics or chemistry, you would know that the specific heat of water is much larger than for solid material like land, and so oceans take longer to heat. So all of these things mean that the atmosphere itself is subject to non-uniform heating, and so there's energy and mass flow to try to adjust everything to get an equilibrium. Now, the climate modelers, the climate science modelers, they're called AOGC models for atmospheric, oceanic, general circulation models, set out to try to treat the entire coupled system of the atmosphere, the oceans, and the land. And they do this by using huge supercomputer models, and they chop the problem up into little blocks, and then through conservation of energy, mass, and so forth, they track the movements of energy and mass from one block to the other. The problem is these things, it's obviously of a heroic scale, and so it's complicated, but also inevitably these models have many approximations in them. And the underlying science is not difficult, it's well understood. It isn't like trying to understand cosmology. It's just that the problem, the scale of the problem, is so big and it's so complicated. These boxes that these giant computer models use that chop the Earth up into boxes on the surface of the Earth and then chunks of the atmosphere, even the biggest ones have boxes that are something like 50 miles by 50 miles square by a half mile vertically. And obviously the processes that act to determine whether water vapor turns into a cloud or whether it rains or whatever, those happen on a microscopic scale compared to the size of those boxes. So they end up making a lot of approximations, and there's nothing you can do about that. Okay, of all of the 1,000-page IPCC latest report, 2007, I'm going to show you one result. And I think this is the central result, and it is a prediction here we are in 2010 now, about here, and this is a prediction about how much global surface temperatures will warm over the 21st century. Now, the different colored bands correspond to different assumptions, different scenarios about how economic development and population development will occur in the 21st century. I'm not going to get into all of those different scenarios. I'm just going to ask you to look at the A2 scenario, which is this red line right here. Now, that's more or less the scenario that is predicted if there continues to be strong regional economic development and not very much transitioning to alternative fuel sources than fossil fuels. And so the prediction is that if we continue on that trajectory, namely we don't do the kinds of things that the politicians are talking about maybe needing to do, the average prediction about how much the temperatures will go up, it's shown over here in this bar here, it's something like 3.4 degrees centigrade. But there's an uncertainty. The UN report says it could be as little as 2 degrees, or it could be as big as 5.4 degrees. Now, why is there all that uncertainty? Well, for one reason, these models are complicated. There are about 20 or 25 of these huge models created by huge groups of scientists around the world. And each one of those groups, they all have smart people in them, and they make different approximations to try to understand best how the climate will actually perform. So the end result is that when you ask all of these models what will happen in that A2 scenario, they give different results. And so these reports end up averaging the predictions of those different models because they can't distinguish one model from the other, and that's why you get this range right here. Now, 2 to 5.4 degrees centigrade is a fair amount, but even more fun, that's not the end of the story. If you ask, at 2100, the oceans are still heating up if you've loaded the atmosphere with that much CO2. And so if you have as much CO2 in the atmosphere as what you'd loaded it up with at that point, the equilibrium temperature in these models would vary somewhere between 4.2 and 9.4 degrees centigrade. Now that's getting to be real numbers. 10 degrees centigrade, 8 to 10 degrees centigrade is the difference in temperature between a glacial age and an interglacial age. So that's real stuff. Question is, should we get worried or not? Well, how accurate are these models likely to be? I talked about how there are 20 to 25 of these big models. There's not enough science understanding to differentiate one model from the other, so the results are averaged. The results are darn complicated, and the scientists that do them know that. When you read the science literature, there's an awful lot of discussion and lamenting among the scientists about why can't we improve this, why can't we improve that, and so forth. So it isn't that they're deluded. They're working very hard on these things. The models all have something in them which actually doesn't even take a giant fancy model to understand. It's simple physics or chemistry. And this has been understood since the 1950s by actually a man named Gilbert Plass, who built guided missile weapons for a day job and at night did climate science. But anyway, he understood that if you loaded the atmosphere with carbon dioxide, sometimes skeptics say, well, carbon dioxide isn't as important a greenhouse gas as water vapor. So what's the big deal? Well, the point is that he understood, and they talk sometimes about a well-mixed atmosphere. And what that means is the carbon dioxide, the water vapor doesn't go very high because the atmosphere gets colder as you go higher and the water precipitates out, turns into rain, turns into clouds, whatever. The CO2 doesn't do that. And the CO2 tends to be higher that you stick into the atmosphere than the water vapor below it. And so if you like, it acts as an extra blanket. And so even though it isn't as potent in a molecular sense, a greenhouse gas, as the water vapor, it really does make a difference. And he knew that. And the models all have that effect. So what goes on in these models is that if you increase the CO2, if you double the CO2, you increase the temperature by about a degree centigrade. But because of the increased temperature, the predicted water vapor goes up also. And that's called positive feedback. And that's what makes the overall predicted temperature increases to be so big compared to what they would be if it was just carbon dioxide. The question, however, is, what does the water vapor do? Nobody knows. And I'll show you, and I'll come back to human-caused aerosols, but let me not do that right now. Let me show you what I mean by the uncertainty about water vapor. Here are 20 models that give you a prediction about how much the temperature will increase if you double the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. Now, here's one down here that says, well, only modest changes will happen. Temperatures will go up by 1.8 degrees. The other one up here is near the high end. The temperatures will go up 4.5 degrees. Huge difference. Okay, what's the fundamental reason why those models are so different? Well, over here, this is a illustration of the change in low-lying cloud cover if you double the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. This orangey, muddy color means you have more low-lying clouds. The blue means you have fewer low-lying clouds than if you, you know, compared to back when you didn't double the CO2. So look what's happening. It's easy to see. This model is keeping things relatively cool because it says all that extra water vapor turns into a lot of low-lying clouds, and low-lying clouds reflect the sun's energy fairly effectively, so it doesn't heat up as much. This model predicts the opposite. Now, no one knows which one is more realistic. And again, it's not that the group that made this model consists of a bunch of dumbheads. They're both struggling to try to come up with the best approximations. This is from the Princeton Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Lab, and this is from the National Consortium on Atmospheric Research. So I think this illustrates very beautifully why it is that these models are running such big uncertainties about what the fate, our fate will be if we increase CO2 significantly. Okay, the other point I want to talk about on the science is whether or not we understand the recent temperature record. And I'm doing this because you can read a lot of, there's a lot of skepticism in the regard that, well, temperatures fluctuate. And the models that these characters are running don't really understand where those fluctuations come from. So if they don't understand where they come from, let's just reject the whole notion of modeling, all right? So I want to talk about that because I don't believe it. So this is the recent temperature record. Now, the thermometers were used for this stuff. And we go back to 1880 and up through the present. The last entry there is 2009. And you can see there's a lot of bouncing around of the surface temperatures. Where do these data come from? They come from, this comes from NOAA. There are three groups in the world that try to compile these records. And I think it's one of the most complicated, probably unrewarding jobs there can be in science. They have to somehow assimilate the individual temperature records from close to 10,000 separate observation stations scattered around the land and the oceans of the surface of the Earth and figure out which ones to believe, which ones not to believe, and end up having to assign error bars and stuff. So anyway, they're all compatible. The three groups get results which are not the same, but they're not remarkably different. And these vertical, for any of you who do science or any kinds of measurements, these vertical bars here is this group's estimate of the uncertainty associated with the points. In other words, they're 95% confident that while there's an uncertainty in the measurement, the true value of the temperature lies somewhere in the range of that vertical bar. So one thing that any scientist would do, first thing, because it's easy, is you see some data and you see if you can draw a straight line through it. Well, so there's my eyeball straight line. And it has a slope of 7/10 of a degree per century. Not all that much. Not all that much has happened yet. But I think anybody with either a trained or untrained eye can see that this is begging for an explanation, some comments on, well, yeah, fine, but how come there's so much structure there? It sure isn't linear. It isn't smooth. What's going on? Is this a mystery or not? Well, I claim not. And I don't have time to get into lots of details about this, but I want to show you a plausibility argument that suggests this kind of thing is not mysterious at all. Before I do that, I can't resist. See, this is the hyperbole thing. and both sides are guilty of it. Right in here in the 80s and 90s, see how things seem to be going up fast? So too many climate scientists looking for 15 minutes of fame would get on television or something and say, oh, things are even worse than our models told us they would be. Temperatures are really going through the roof. Well, now those same people have to be pretty quiet if that's the game they want to play, because not much has happened for the last 10 years. Now, a scientist knows that if you see that size uncertainty, those error bars, that you shouldn't get excited one way or the other. You shouldn't be claiming great things just because for 10 years or so things happen to be going up quickly here, or for that matter, for 10 years or so things don't particularly, are not increasing and so forth. So people have to be careful about that. Okay, so let me just suggest to you how one understands this, these fluctuations, because you hear a lot about this, a lot of criticism. This particular paper, Judith Lean is head of a very large satellite experimental program at the Naval Research Lab, and this is a paper of hers from last year. And what she and her co-authors set out to do is ask, can we understand this fluctuating temperature record from 1980 to 2010? And what they did is they say, look, we know about four influences for surface temperatures. One is the intensity of the sun. And everybody knows, or many people know, that the solar irradiance varies with 11-year cycles. Here's a picture of it. It's also well known that when volcanoes go off, they spew aerosols way up into the stratosphere. They sit there for quite a long time, and they basically act as coolants because they tend to reflect sunlight. So they tend to lower the temperature of the Earth. We also hear a lot about El Nino, Southern Oscillation. We know that it's an effect that tends to warm things. So you can't see the colors very differently here. Here's the volcano picture. This is Mount Pinatubo in 1992, and so forth and so on. And these are particularly intense periods of the El Nino, like so. And the last driver influence is the modeled, assumed monotonically increasing influence of the anthropogenic greenhouse gas effect. And so these authors, like scientists do, ask themselves, if we combine these four functional forms, can we understand how these fluctuations go? And I think they do a pretty good job here. They also caution in the paper that because of these sorts of unpredictable influences, a volcano going off, whatever, that we should be careful to be claiming too much about anthropogenic caused effects, because these things, up until now, tend to mask the effect, the anthropogenic effect. In the future, presumably, that wouldn't be the case. But this is a plausibility argument, I think, for being able to understand this stuff. All right, so now let's forget all that, and I just want to, this is a cast of, this is a rogues gallery sort of thing, I think. So perpetrators. Well, on the one side, the Gore movie, media in general, and some scientists. As I've shown you before, they tend to downplay uncertainties. There's too much of the time people associate warming with human-caused warming, and too much of the time want to say that every time there's an extreme event, it must mean something about models. On the skeptic side, this is just a quick list. I love the remark that models aren't evidence. Well, yeah, I know that. But on the other hand, modern societies depend on models. We use animal models to decide about efficacies of drugs. We use models to design efficient combustion engines for airplanes, for furnaces, for whatever. We use models to design buildings, to design, you know, da-da-da-da-da. So yeah, models aren't evidence, but it's the way we do technology and science. CO2 is good for us. I fail to understand. We can talk about it if you want. Third one, CO2 lag as temperature increases during interglacials. We'll see this in the Gore movie. Shows CO2 doesn't have anything to do with temperature increase. And then in italics, something else has caused it. The computer models don't know what it is. Well, I'm going to show you about that. And finally, as we talked about, lack of warming means the whole, in recent years, means the whole thing is a hoax. So let's look at some of this stuff. So here's Al Gore, and he wants us to believe that the case is 100% made and we better get going, right? And so so he shows, here's CO2. We saw this curve, this just is a different scale. And over here we see temperature record for the last 1,000 years. And this curve looks terribly smooth, doesn't it? That actually is the curve produced by Professor Michael Mann at University of Virginia, who is of much interest to Mr. Cuccinelli these days. And I don't really want to get into that. However, remember that in the curve I showed you of the whole ensemble of paleo temperature records, there is a lot of scatter. I mean, we don't know exactly what went on. But on the other hand, the range of temperature variability wasn't very much. Remember, I said it was about a degree. So whether the curve is exactly like that or not, I don't think makes much difference. The other point is cause and effect. Yeah, so they're correlated, but that still doesn't tell us which causes the other. Now, this he also showed, and I think this is more serious. These are data from NOAA. They were published in Science Magazine in 2001, and his movie was made in 2006. And on the face of it, it's an absolutely gorgeous set of data, I think. These are extracted from ice cores in Antarctica that go down 3.3 kilometers. And by slicing the strata of the ice cores and doing isotopic analysis and abundance analysis, you can actually deduce the temperature record going back 400,000 years. So these are going back four glacial cycles. The temperature is shown in black. I'm sorry, the temperature is shown in red, which is right here, and this is the present over here, so we're going back in time like this. It's been adjusted so it says 0 degrees right here. So in the last glacial period, we were down here about 8 degrees centigrade colder than we are right now. Now, the blue lines correspond to carbon dioxide concentration, and lo and behold, they're correlated. When the temperature's high, the carbon dioxide is high. Now, the crucial problem is that Al Gore said about this graph, he said, the relationship between the carbon dioxide and the temperature is, quote, complicated. Now, it isn't complicated. And in fact, it's led to his savaging by a lot of skeptics for misrepresenting things, and I think with a certain, quite a bit of justification, actually. Because it was already known that if you blow these data apart and look very carefully, that the carbon dioxide increase lags the temperature increase by several hundred years. So it is not true that the carbon dioxide is causing the temperature to go up. On the other hand, I would ask you to agree with me, so what? And the reason for that is that the question is whether carbon dioxide is a driver of temperature change or just a respondent to temperature change. And it is a fact that if you heat the world up for some reason, that you will, as you heat the oceans, you will take carbon dioxide out of the warmer oceans. They'll give it up. Permafrost has a lot of carbon dioxide in it, so forth and so on. So by any mechanism, if you heat up the world, you'll have more carbon dioxide. The question about what drove what is completely unaddressed by these data right here. And I just want to be very clear about that. Before I leave the graph, though, I just want to say one other thing, and that is that I'm talking too long. The other thing is you know that this must have been wrong. Now, I confess, when I left the movie, my wife said, you know, you better get with the program. You better believe in all this stuff. And I believe my wife. But actually, if I had been thinking about, if I had been thinking at all, I would have said, wait a minute, there's something funny here. And so here's what's funny about this. The beautiful data, the carbon dioxide swings like this. Here's the carbon dioxide concentration. It swings by about 100 parts per million volume. Well, duh, that's exactly the swing in carbon dioxide that we've looked at over the last 50 years. Did the temperature go up by 8 degrees? No. It went up about 7-tenths of a degree. So obviously, this doesn't have really much of anything to do with the situation that we're talking about right now. So that's enough harangue about that. Let's go to something else, another thing in the movie. And I go through this. I appreciate that he did a lot of good science and that he probably was very well intentioned in bringing the urgency of the problem to the public's attention. But I wonder whether some of these presentation features on balance didn't hurt the result. And so he showed a picture of hurricane damages. Warm things up, more hurricanes, right? And so look here. Hurricane damage is going way up. Astoundingly, this graph came from the report of a consortium of insurance companies. Now, insurance companies could care less about global warming. What they want to think about is how many dollars do they pay out in a given year, right? If you make the correction that anybody would know to do, and you adjust it, first of all, for currency inflation, but also for the fact that as people have gotten more affluent, more of them tend to live in hurricane-prone areas, you don't see any pattern at all, right? So much for that. And now, just to finish this off, hurricanes striking the U.S. mainland. Here is a plot. Number of hurricanes by decade. So it ends here, 1990, 1999. The blue is all hurricanes, any category that hit the U.S. mainland. The red is category 4 or 5. Now, I just checked with NOAA, actually, yesterday, because I wanted the data for the decade we just finished. And the decade we just finished, the blue bar should be right here at 19. And the red bar, the severe storm, should be at 1 again. So put imagine that there. You see, there are just so many fluctuations. It's hard to see much of any kind of pattern. And I think it just confuses people to claim that there's a clear increase in hurricanes related to global warming. Again, hyperbole, distortion, whatever. Incidentally, there's a hurricane expert at UVA, Bob Davis, who told me that they can't figure out in the hurricane community really exactly what may happen as a result of global warming. On one hand, the average ocean temperatures are higher, so there's more energy to create hurricanes. On the other hand, the thinking is that it might turn out that if you had more high-level winds, that the winds would tend to cause shearing so that you might, for example, get more hurricanes, but they might not be more intense, or something like that. But his real message is, we just don't know. Okay, summary about the science. We're in a warming period, but so far not very dramatic. Now, I haven't talked about loss of Arctic ice cover. I haven't talked about differential warming in the high latitudes compared to the low latitudes, all sorts of things, but we can do that later. We're definitely in a warming period. I think nobody really debates that. Observations are consistent with warming being due to increasing greenhouse gases, but none of the scientific literature says that it's 100% certain. It's highly likely is a characterization and so forth, but in science you just can never be completely sure. Congress 2 years ago asked our own National Academy of Sciences to give still another comprehensive report on the status of the climate science and if there is a strong case for us needing to do something about greenhouse gases, what should the way forward be to take action. I think it's interesting to remember that we don't have any better organization than the National Academy of Sciences. The National Academy of Sciences was formed by Abraham Lincoln. And it was created because Lincoln wanted access to the best possible scientific advice for national purposes. So this is Blue Ribbon. And so they did their study, and this is their, it was came out just a few weeks ago, and this is their summary statement. So the problem, however, is what to do. The model predictions have very large uncertainties, and obviously the uncertainties make public decision-making and actions even harder than they would be otherwise. After all, we've grown completely used to using fossil fuels for everything, right? Okay, so what to do about this, particularly if you're a policymaker? Well, policy questions and choices. Do nothing. That's one approach. Ask, what's the society cost of transitioning from fossil fuels to other energy sources compared to the cost of doing nothing? Now, this compounds the modeling uncertainty, right? I already talked about how modeling climate is god-awful complicated. So now, fine, let's take complicated, uncertain results and let's meld them with models of economies and other sorts of social science things. How much are we likely to hurt the GDP, for example, in the year 2100? How do we do social discounting? How do we value that damage in 2100 compared to what we're doing right now? All of those things. On the other hand, modeling is great fun for the practitioners of the models, and even complications aside, they certainly have been doing modeling, and I want to just show you some of that before I quit. So escalate the modeling. Combine climate science with economic modeling. So here we go. So we get answers accompanied by more uncertainties. So now, here's just, I'm almost done. This is the second but last slide, or third but last. So the Brits started this game. Gordon Brown asked a distinguished economics professor at the London School of Economics, Nicholas Stern, to do an analysis all the way out to 2100. And the question was, considering what the model damages will be out there, how should we set aside money to do environment, climate, greenhouse gas reductions to avoid the potential catastrophes? On the other hand, we don't want to set aside too much money because then that will just throttle down the standard economies built on fossil fuel, right? So it's a balancing act. So, okay, so he does it. And his objective is he has a modeled outcome of the temperature no more than 1.2 degrees centigrade. He's got that in 2020, you should pay $372 a ton of carbon emissions. I'll want to put that in real terms in just a second. But look how varied these things are. Here's William Nordhaus, who's a distinguished professor at Yale, who does his own modeling. And he figures that he's going to hold it to that. His cost per ton is $48 in 2005 dollars starting in 2010. Of course, these things ramp up because the assumption is you transition to away from fossil fuels. And now the National Academy of Sciences relates to something called the Energy Modeling Forum, which is a huge consortium, Stanford-led. It has a lot of companies involved in it, a lot of universities. And their modeling, they say, is consistent with that House resolution we saw. Their tax in 2020 is down here around $15 to $30. Now, look what happens. Suppose, once again, I did that. Suppose you just take $48, because clearly they're all over the map, but let's just take that as an example. To put that into real terms, if you imposed a $48 tax per ton of carbon, our gas prices would go up 13 cents a gallon. Our electricity bill would go up 1.4 cents per kilowatt hour. Now we spend, what, about 10 cents. So it's a manageable effect. That's the size of what would go on. The nation's tax bill would go up by $75 billion, but I think it's interesting. You may want to ponder the fact that $75 billion should be compared to the $188 billion that was part of our national deficit in 2009 that we sent to the folks in the Middle East. So 75 billion is a large number, but it isn't very large compared to that. Okay, thoughts on what needs to happen. The climate science community needs to do a better job of helping the public to understand. No hyperbole, no hype. Let's all agree there are huge uncertainties in the modeling. I haven't talked much about human-related aerosols, but that's another contributor to uncertainties. I think let's all agree that modeling is the way we advance things in this society, and it isn't very productive to say that we can ignore models. The idea is we should just make the modeling better. I think the skeptics that are not skeptical about details of the science, let me put it that way, have a burden to show why these giant global circulation models can safely be dismissed. And I would outlaw all of this stuff, and we really need to have intelligent public discussion. The question we can talk about is it possible? And this is a sort of a downer ending, so I have one more slide for you. And so here's some art. This is a magazine, Science Fiction, Amazing Stories, early 1950s. And you see that New York City is inundated by glaciers. But that was just an ordinary conventional ice age, the next ice age. We're more refined and sophisticated these days. So in 2004, we had the day after tomorrow. Now, the effect on New York City was pretty much the same, except that this happened overnight. And it happened because of, guess what, global warming. Global warming caused the Gulf Stream to shut down, which, of course, keeps us fairly warm. And so the ice descended on us. So there's lots of fun doing, you can have lots of fun with climate and science fiction. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Bob, very much. That's a lot of information, but hopefully has created a few questions, and we do have time for a few questions. So, yes, anybody?
One of the factors that I think is distorting the public dialogue is that there are strong economic vested interests in the status quo, so that you have a petroleum industry that if they were facing significant conservation or a significant transition to solar power would see the value of their oil reserves or coal reserves diminish greatly, the whole value of their enterprise would diminish, and they're adding to the distortion and the hyperbole on the skeptic side and helping to prevent a really rational approach to making this transition. I mean, there are a lot of other reasons to make a transition from fossil fuels to renewable energy that's sustainable over the long haul. But I think you could add that to your list of problems.
Is this on?
Yes.
Yeah, I agree. Although I think it's interesting, a number of large corporations now have reached the point where they're saying, look, we just want to know what the policy is. A lot of power plants, for example, are old and need to be, new ones need to be created. And the utility company want to know, what is the policy going to be? What's the floor price of carbon going to be? So they can plan accordingly to move on. But, yeah.
This may be a rather historic meeting because you've done something that I have not heard before. And I've heard a lot about climate in the last few years. And that is you've synthesized a combination of ideas that make it an easily understandable thing, even though we don't understand it fully. We don't understand the unintended consequences of everything that we do. And so the question comes up in the final analysis, I think, to take the advice you're giving us today, that is to look at things on a basis of a better understanding. We can't predict everything. We don't know whether we're going to have a comet strike us in a few months or a few days or tomorrow, for that matter. We don't, but we're going on the premise that we're going to be around for a little bit of time, at least our lifetime. And to me, I think what you've done is to balance things out. And I have no comments of any kind except to say thanks.
Do you have any suggestions on how to deal with the education of the public to get away from the extremism, especially those of us involved in geologic history? I find it very easy to deal with thousands of years and hundreds of years, and the lifetime of a person is insignificant to that. But that's not the average person, and I don't think we can change that concept overnight at all. So time is one of the problems, I think. And the other is how to analyze the information and where it's coming from. That is something that can be taught in schools, being skeptics and how to evaluate things. But it's just not happening. So I feel very discouraged in some areas as far as helping having the public have a better attitude toward all this.
Yeah, I agree. I think this situation calls for, because there is almost zero, maybe zero, intelligent discussion about things. I should say that in the background, behind the stage, if you read the current science literature by the important people doing the science, there is perfectly healthy debate back and forth, just like scientists do, about who knows what, why don't we know more about that, and so forth and so on. In fact, my field is nuclear physics, which is about as, well, I did some high energy physics too, and that's about as divorced from interest to the public and public policy considerations as anything you can think of. And so those folks sitting back in some sort of enclave of science doing that, there's good back and forth and challenging and so forth and so on. I see much the same thing going on in the climate science community. So it isn't the climate scientists that need some help, it's the interfacing with the science and the public, which is your point. The media, yeah. I actually did my best, but failed, to encourage an institution such as the Miller Center to put on the kind of forum that could maybe be shown on at least PBS or something. It would almost be it would be more substantive than a presidential debate, okay? It would be that some spokespeople for both sides would come together in front of a blue ribbon panel, and it wouldn't just be scientists, it would be serious people. The issues would be put on the table, and just to get extra bang for the buck, I think it should be more than one session. In other words, there would be assertions, there would be this and that, then there would be a follow-up where there'd hopefully be some sort of synthesis on here's what we can agree on, so forth and so on, and then go forward. I know columnists as on opposite sides of the political spectrum, such as George Will and Thomas Friedman, are both getting to the point where they're urging some sort of a commission, a blue ribbon commission to make pronouncements. Now, the National Academy of Sciences is as blue ribbon a science body as we have, but I guess because it's a science body, maybe even that doesn't have the right...
Last winter, we heard a lot of snickering about, sure, global warming, and that's where all the snow, etc., etc. I was trying to explain it to myself, probably in a very absurd way. But as the polar ice melts and chunks of icebergs enter possibly the Gulf Stream, which would cool down, could this account for potentially colder winters along the eastern shore of the United States?
Yes, but the expectations, that's essentially, that's like what we said in this science fiction thing where we shut down the Gulf Stream. The expectations are that even if we do nothing, and continue to dump greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, that the Gulf Stream won't shut down for another 100 years or so. So at least. So that's probably not what happened last winter. I want to say, though, that a lot of people again, I keep using this metaphor of the supermarket aisles, somehow associate snow with coldness. And they're not the same thing, right? You can have lots of snow when it isn't cold. It just has to be more or less below freezing. And in fact, sometimes I hear people say, well, but the Arctic ice cover is rather dramatically shrinking, but the Antarctica ice sheet isn't shrinking. So what do you think about that? Well, the point is that the Antarctic is so cold that actually, if you created a situation where on average there's more water vapor in the air, you might actually have more ice in Antarctica because you'd have more snow, and it would never melt. So just because you see snow and so forth, it doesn't really tell us much at all about what's going on with the temperatures. So,
hi. I was thinking maybe we could ask your comment about reframing the debate instead of the number of degrees of temperature, the impact to the public health, and also even though there's few lower probability of accidents, like with this BP oil spill, in pursuing these energy policies, you have a possibility of creating huge catastrophes as a result. So maybe that would encourage people, rather than the numerical number of degrees, the temperature is going up.
Yeah. Well, I agree, but as you know, there's a lot of discussion now with this horrible thing in the Gulf about whether that'll in fact help to push public policy.
You started off by saying this was an unprecedented case of scientists presenting a scenario that demands action. Actually, there is a prior case, not as strong as this. I don't disagree at all with your assertion, but I point out that 30 years ago, some atmospheric chemists suddenly realized that there was a problem in the atmosphere regarding ozone, and it was a special chemical reaction that would occur that would destroy the ozone. I actually had a friend at the time who was an atmospheric chemist, and he attended the meeting where this was first reported, came back, and we were sitting at a coffee hour, and he told us, scientists, what I just heard at a meeting in Los Angeles, you know, and these guys are right. We all think they're right. Almost immediately, everybody realized the model and the theory were right, and that ultimately led to a campaign internationally to reduce the fluorohydrocarbons that CFCs that were causing the ozone destruction, and the campaign has been largely successful. And this was done even though we didn't fully understand all the physics involved. The chemists were quite confident about the chemistry. Some of the physics wasn't fully understood, surface chemistry and that sort of thing. You agree with me that?
Totally. You're. Thank you. You're right. Hi.
Bob, as we all know in this room, there is no free lunch, and you not only have a problem of explaining and trying to sell a particular case one way or the other in this, but there's a cost to it, and you addressed that in bringing up the economics. But you have the problem of who's going to pay for this? Is there going to be a decline in the standard of living? Is the public going to be willing to accept that? And one of the things that I think really, even though you presented, I thought, an excellent model there as to possible cost, is how are you going to sell this to the public, not only from the scientific point of view, but the cost? Would you comment?
I showed you that there's an uncertainty in the cost, but let's just look at one of those typical numbers like I showed you. Now, my personal opinion is, that's a cost that we can bear. It's not going to break anything. But the other thing that I'm reminded of is that human beings on an individual scale are very used to delayed consumption. For example, parents typically invest in their children's education on the expectation that that will make things better for future for their future generations and so forth. Individuals typically buy fire insurance for their homes. Now, on average, they lose money, right? Cost them something. They don't get to buy the next car or something. But on the other hand, it insures against a catastrophic event. Now, I think that kind of thinking needs to be in this, but I also think, and many people have written about this, I think that forget climate and all of this stuff. I mean, it is just nutty that we're in a position right now of increasingly competing with the rest of the world for what, any way you cut it, is going to be a diminishing resource of at least fossil fuel in the form of oil. There's almost unlimited amounts of coal, but oil is particularly important because it's so easy for, it's so useful for transportation. And, you know, we're more and more in a competitive race with China and so forth and so on to be able to get that stuff. So in not many years, instead of spending $188 billion sending it offshore to the Middle East, that number is going to be a lot higher. And so I think it can be presented that, yeah, we'd prefer not to have to do this, but it's time to get on with it. Now, I think people that get the big bucks, right? I mean, I'm looking for them to lead us on this. I would, I like a lot of what President Obama does, but I think it's time for him to try to make the political leadership case for all of this. And I know it's going to be plenty hard, but somebody needs to step up there and do it. Lately, he, in his State of the Union address in February or January, I was disappointed that when he mentioned clean energy, he doesn't talk about climate change anymore, he talks about clean energy. And when he brought that up, there was a fair amount of snickering from one side of the house. And he turned to them and said, even if you don't believe in climate change, surely you believe in national security. Now, I think that's a correct statement, but I think that if you lop off, if you don't remember that we need to do things in a certain trajectory to try to do best we can on what we think we understand about climate, then we're not going to get the best, the optimal action for increasing the price of use of fossil fuels. That wasn't stated very well, but.
Okay, folks, we have, in the interest and respect of all of you and of Bob, one more question.
You had mentioned feedback and problems with feedback, but I think this is really a scary part of the whole problem that hasn't really been addressed. If the atmosphere is controlled by massive sets of coupled differential equations, and if you've ever tried working with these, you find that occasionally they do go unstable in a way that you could never conceivably have predicted. Any messing around we do with the climate, whether it's going to warm things or cool things or do anything, we have to worry about hitting some kind of a tipping point or whether we're in a little metastable area, and if we change things too much, all of a sudden we hit feedback and the things go bad, like when your microphone squeals when you talk a little bit too loudly in it. These things can happen, and they're really very unpredictable. And I think that's a concern that people who say, well, let it go up, you know, it's not going to make a difference. This should be more of a concern.
I agree with that. And incidentally, in these models where they try to model costs and so forth, and all of the modelers, I mean, they're very straightforward. They write about all the things they don't understand. And one of the things that they caution is we're assuming that we're not going to reach some tipping point where things go into some other state. And so, yeah, that's very much on their minds. By the way, I always forget to say this, and I know we're running late, but you know that curve that I showed you from the ice core data from the Antarctic that goes back 400,000 years, and you can see four different glacial to interglacial eras? Those are those are bimodal, right? Flip-flop. I mean, you go from one state to the other. So do we have even any inkling about why that happens? Sometimes people say, oh, that's all a mystery. Well, it is not a mystery. The conventional thinking is there's something called Milankovitch cycles. And the orientation and the orbit of the Earth with respect to the Sun, because of perturbations from near-lying planets, it actually slightly tilts and changes its position, its distance with respect to the Sun, at intervals which are completely predictable from astronomy. And these things happen on the order of 100,000 years with subcycles of the order of 40,000 years. So the thinking is that's what kicks the system from one state to another. Now, am I going to stand here and tell you that people know how to model all of that stuff precisely? Of course not. But at least there's a sense that you know the underlying reason for why those sorts of things happen. And by the way, of course, here's our amazing stories. I mean, they've got it right on the money, right? I mean, at some point in another hundreds of years or thousands of years or whatever, presumably we'll begin to go back into an ice age, so then none of us have to worry.
Bob, I want to thank you very, very much. I want to add that Sue had to go to another meeting that she has back at Branchland, so she asked me to wrap it up for her. One of the purposes of the Senior Statesman of Virginia is to influence wherever your best decisions make in the policymakers and the people who put out the word. Bob had mentioned that he'd made an attempt to get the Miller Center to conduct a forum on this, and that seems to be an excellent place. So if there's anything that you can do to help encourage the spread of the word of the presentations that Bob has made or any of the other ones that you feel are worth making, please urge those people, the congressmen, the people at the Miller Center, or whoever else, to get behind this, because it's really important that we get the word out. And again, I want to thank Bob for an excellent presentation.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.